San Francisco Experience Podcast, brought to you by Jim Herlihy, independent commentary from a Silicon Valley perspective for a global audience, featuring newsmakers, thought leaders, and authors. Season 26, Episode 1, Australia and the AUKUS Pact, in conversation with Gareth Evans, former Foreign Minister of Australia. He joins us from his office in Melbourne. Hello, Gareth, and welcome to the show.
Hi, Jim. Delighted to talk to you.
Our guest today served in Australia's Senate and House of Representatives from 1978 to 1999. From 1983 to 1996, he served as a cabinet minister in the Hawke and Keating governments as Attorney General, Minister for Resources and Energy, Minister for Transport and Communications, and notably as Minister of Foreign Affairs for 8 years from 1988 to 1996. He remains one of the two longest-serving federal cabinet ministers in Labour Party history. He went on to serve as president and CEO of the International Crisis Group in Brussels. Then he became Chancellor of the Australian National University from 2010 to 2020, and he continues to serve as an honorary professor at the Australian National University. He's the author of 13 books. A very proud record of service to his country. Gareth, please give us an overview of Australia's principal foreign policy goals and some of your own accomplishments. Cambodia and Timor come to mind, for instance, while you were foreign minister.
Australia has always had the desire to cut an independent figure in our own region and to play a constructive role internationally. That waxes and wanes a bit depending on whether it's the Labour Party or Conservative Party is in office, but the aspirations are basically the same. When I became foreign minister in the early, late 80s, early 90s, it was a time of tremendous optimism about the art of the possible in international affairs, both regionally and globally. You know, the Cold War ice flows had broken. There was cooperation visible and possible in the Security Council. There was new scope for cooperative activity, particularly around our region, the creation of new security and economic dialogue architecture. And Australia played a very active role in all of that, both internationally in the UN, arguing for UN reform, but more particularly regionally in the creation of APEC, the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The new security dialogue architecture, the ASEAN Regional Forum, and we played a pretty active role, as well known, in peacemaking efforts, particularly over Cambodia, where it was the Australian plan that was basically adopted that mm-hmm. brought peace to that poor, benighted country. We didn't succeed all that well in producing democracy and human rights for the long haul, but we did produce peace at last after a terrible, grinding, awful history. So Australia, I think, did have a pretty good reputation over that period. My approach to foreign policy was to recognize that every country's foreign policy has to be primarily, obviously, about protecting, advancing the national interest. And the traditional way of articulating that national interest is in terms of security interests on the one hand and economic prosperity, trade interests on the other. But I argued right from the beginning, and it's been a consistent theme of everything I've stood for over the years, I've argued that every country has a third national interest, and that's in being and being seen to be a good international citizen, mm-hmm. which I mean a country that is not just concerned with its own immediate and obvious self-interest, but genuinely with our common humanity and advancing and improving the scene and so far as regional global public goods are concerned. When it comes to aid policy, human rights policy, dealing with existential risk issues like climate and so on, but also in the area of peacemaking, peacekeeping, peace building, and response to atrocity crime. So in all those areas, Australia was pretty active, not just because we saw it as a moral imperative, but because we did see some genuine national advantage in reputational terms, reciprocity terms, in so acting. So the concept of Australia as an active, independent, engaged, creative, middle power, working through coalition building strategies, focused on cooperative strategies, dialogue strategy, has been very much my shtick, very much the shtick of Labour governments successively. And I think it does touch a chord with the Australian public. And in that context, I might just mention before we start on AUKUS, there's a very interesting survey just a couple of weeks ago by mm-hmm. the Australian Guardian about what people thought Australia's role in global affairs should be. And the majority was an independent middle power with influence in the Asia-Pacific, 38%. Only 20%, I'm sad to say, from the point of view of the United States, saw our role in global affairs as primarily as an ally of the United States. There's much more disposition to think of ourselves as an active, independent sort of middle power. And that's the context in which the debate is now proceeding in Australia, I guess, on the AUKUS, the virtue of it and the utility of it and the deliverability of it.
It's interesting that we're having, or Australia's having, the debate about AUKUS, but the two prime ministers and the president came together in San Diego not that long ago to essentially announce AUKUS. So how come we're having the debate after the agreement has already been signed off on? And I guess there's still a lot of detail, you know, devil's in the details, as they say, but I guess there's still a lot of detail to be worked out. But why are we having the discussion now as opposed to before AUKUS? It seemed to pop up pretty quickly.
Well, it's a very good question. I mean, I think the political imperative was seen as very compelling by all three governments. And there wasn't a lot of time and attention devoted to working through the implications of it, the deliverability of it, and I'll come to that. But also, I don't think there was sufficient attention paid to the cost-benefit. We should get clear what the basic deal is. AUKUS is in two tranches. Mm-hmm. The uncontroversial tranche is agreement between the United States, UK, and Australia for a much higher level of integrated research on new defence technology areas like cyber AI, quantum mechanics, undersea technology. And that's not especially not controversial at all. Mm-hmm. Whether it's deliverable at all is another question, but it's not controversial. What has become controversial is and most visible is the idea of the US giving us the technology to have nuclear-propelled submarines, not nuclear-armed, but nuclear-propelled, with the idea being that we get three Virginia-class boats from the US, the earliest delivery in the 2030s, and we get, over a longer period, five wholly newly designed boats, three-way design, US, UK, and Australia, that will give us, you know, by the 40s and 50s, another five, you know, supremely capable underwater machines. So that's the nature of the deal that was on the table and got everybody excited back in September 21 when it was announced, which the Labor government, when it came into office a few months later in early 22, embraced without any hesitation, or I think without an awful lot of thought or research, mainly again because of the politics of this. It did seem to be an important development. But let's just explore what is prima facie in it. What made it attractive? What still makes it attractive for a whole bunch of people, not least the defence and intelligence community in all three of our countries. Look, from the United States' point of view, what makes it attractive in the first instance is that it does send a signal to China that here is a new significant allied force projection capability in the making. Mm-hmm. It's a recognition that it's a quantum increase in the intensity of the alliance relationship with the degree of enmeshment, not only in delivery of the technology, but all the support that goes with it. And Kurt Campbell, I think your newly appointed Deputy Secretary of State, let the cat out of the bag in terms of the US interest in this, when he's reported as saying privately at the end of 22 that this deal, this submarine deal, this AUKUS deal, gets Australia off the fence. We have them locked in for the next 40 years. Mm-hmm. So any residual doubts there might have been in about the residual commitment to the alliance relationship in Australia, this is seen as really, really locking us in. Now, that raised a lot of issues about sovereign agency, which I'll come back to later on. What's in it for the UK? Well, pretty obviously big economic rewards for the design and build of this new boat,
yes,
with Australia making a major commitment. There'll be bucket loads of Australian money going to the Barrow Inverness ship yards, and I think Boris Johnson was visibly super enthusiastic about that economic dimension of it. There's also a kind of political dimension because it plays into this rather nostalgic British interest in projecting itself as still a relevant player on the global stage and in the Indo-Pacific arena in particular. I don't think anybody else sees that as a credible aspiration, but no doubt that's one of the reasons why it got a big tick from the UK political class. It's the economic imperative. For Australia, look, on the face of it, prima facie, this is a huge new technological capability. We're a continent, the size of continental United States.
Yes.
Surrounded by water, facing potential threats over time. I don't think they're very serious at the moment, but they may be over time. You have to cope with this contingency. On three sides, there's not going to be much stress coming from the penguins of Antarctica, but from the north, from the east, from the west. You know, we've got a gigantic coastline, sea lanes to defend. And there's no doubt that submarine capability is the most useful capability in this kind of context. And there's no doubt that nuclear-propelled submarines have an extraordinary degree of endurance, speed, advantage over their nuclear-propelled, over their conventionally propelled, and they also have the advantage of undetectability.
Can I just jump in there? What is the current state of play with Australia's submarine fleet?
We have six conventionally powered boats which have run out of their. Running out rapidly of their lifetime and desperately in need of refurbishment to stay in the water. And that's one of the issues that's really exercising a lot of the critics, that will we, if these boats take as long as they're likely to, with the first one, if all goes well, coming to us in the 2030s, and not having the full complement of 8 new boats until maybe the 2050s, will we have enough residual capability with our existing submarines to cover our defence needs? And that's a real issue. Traction for us was obviously technological. This is super, super swish technology, and it does give you a lot more obvious, you know, capability mm-hmm. when you're dealing with the kind of geography that we are.
Wasn't the original plan to replace the six Collins-class submarines that you currently have that date from the 1990s, wasn't the original plan to replace them with French-built submarines? And then, of course, that deal fell apart, much to the chagrin of President Macron when this came. Could you tell us, so originally the plan was to stick with conventionally powered submarines to be sourced from France. Then, so what made them change from that plan to this plan with the Virginia-class nuclear-powered submarines? Who was the driver behind it?
Well, the driver, obviously, was conversations which took place at a high government level, none of us knowing about it at the time, in which it was put to the US, or the US put it to us, that they would be interested in an unprecedented way in making this extraordinarily sophisticated and secretive technology available to us because we were such a good ally. And people sort of jumped at that because mm-hmm. whatever else you can say about nuclear submarines, they do have this extraordinary endurance capability. They have this extraordinary speed underwater. Mm-hmm. And they are, at the moment, undetectable in the sense that they don't have to come up to snorkel in the way that the conventionally powered boats do. So the Australian government, from the politics of it, domestic politics of it, the then Conservative government's always been very high on defence and security issues, always very, very keen on doing everything to advance the US alliance, and saw this as a way of getting even further into the enmeshment interoperability business with the United States. So that's why they decided, the Australian government, to just basically tear up the agreement with France. There had been issues in terms of relatively slow rollout of the planning and delivery of those boats. About a very large sum had already been spent on the planning side of it, but it was falling behind schedule. And there was a degree of legitimate concern about whether the French would be really able to deliver quickly on the scale that was required with these newly designed boats. But it was the attractions of the US being willing to do something really different with us and really potentially, you know, technologically and militarily significant. Because, you know, Australia's a long way from anywhere, and, and our sea lanes do extend right out into the Indian Ocean, right up and down the Pacific through Southeast Asia. Mm-hmm. And the Collins-class boat, while they're tremendously capable boats and very stealthy and very, they can't spend very long on station. They have to spend an awful lot of steaming time getting up into any sort of potentially contested waters. And prima facie, the attraction was there. And I understand that. And the politics of it, you know, from the incoming Labor government point of view, were, again, pretty straightforward. We had a long tradition of being sort of wedged on national security issues, by our conservative opponents, saying, you know, we were not up to the task, not committed. We were a bunch of wimps when it came to these defence issues. So there was a disposition to take the advantages at face value and not think hard, as I think they should have been thinking hard, about what the real cost benefits of these boats were, because they come at an eye-watering cost. We're talking about nearly $400 billion over the next few decades. Gigantic sum for a country of our size. And you really have to be satisfied in a way that many of us are now not satisfied, that these things really do justify that degree of expense.
Let's come back to Australia's relationship with China. Of course, we saw that through the 1990s, the 2000s, the 2010s, Australia, of course, became a major supplier of natural resources to China. And all during that 25, 30-year period, the Australian economy boomed. There was no recession, while the rest of the world had periodic recessions during that time. Australia had no recessions during that time, in large measure because of the very lucrative natural resource relationship with Australia. But that relationship has somewhat soured. Tell us a little bit about that, because in part it's the souring of that relationship and also the change in the U.S. relationship to China, which is driving this AUKUS submarine deal.
Well, there's plenty to be concerned about in terms of Chinese behavior, the tearing up of international law commitments in the South China Sea, the militarization of those reefs and islets, its internal behavior in Xinjiang, Hong Kong, Tibet. You know, the increased intensity of the posturing over Taiwan, and the increased willingness under Xi Jinping to, you know, to play much more of an activist and indeed on occasion spoiler role in multilateral forums. All of these things were concentrating Australian minds on the necessity to be not just consumed with the economic advantages of our relationship, but to worry about the potential possibility of it going pear-shaped and even, you know, conceivably becoming a source of conflict in the future. So our security and intelligence crowd got themselves very excited about the risks in a way that you're seeing across the partisan divide in the United States, and about efforts to influence Australia and the Huawei exercise with, you know, trying to allegedly embed spyware into our certain telecommunication technology contracts and so on and so forth. That led the previous Australian government, the Conservative government, to start getting very outspoken about all things Chinese and really pretty offensively so. And the immediate issue that generated a breakdown in relations was a call for an independent investigation of the COVID breakout.
Oh, yes.
Now, obviously, as every justification in the world for having an independent international investigation. But this was expressed in a very crude way. It wasn't diplomatically prepared. There was no operational preparedness for it, no discussion with anybody about how this might be done. And it was seen by the Chinese quite rightly as just a poke in the eye. And there were various other, you know, sort of offensive rhetoric. And China decided under those circumstances that, you know, we were possibly the weak underbelly of the US relationship, and therefore we could and should be made an example of. And things got very rough indeed for 3 or 4 years, with the Chinese really imposing a whole bunch of economic boycotts on us and interfering with the trade relationship, not at the expense of their own iron ore purchases or coal purchases, but a lot of other stuff. The United States didn't particularly endear itself to many of us in Australia when a whole bunch of commodities were halted in terms of our trade. I mean, American producers, barley producers, some seafood producers, leapt in very cheerfully to fill the void. But what happened with the change of government in 1922, the advent of a new Labor government, we saw an urgent need to reset the relationship, not to pull back from legitimate criticism, legitimate pushback against Chinese misbehavior, and there's been plenty of that still, but nonetheless to be more realistic about the need for effective cooperation. And the mantra that is governing our relationship with China now is, as articulated by the Prime Minister and the Foreign Ministers, cooperate where we can, disagree where we must, but engage in the national interest. And that's where we are at the moment. There's a current visit to Australia as we speak, the Wang Yi, the foreign minister. And while not everything in the garden is rosy, nor is it likely to be, I think there's a sense of a much better balance in our relationship than we've had for the last few years. And things are reasonably back on track. Nobody is seriously worried for the immediately foreseeable future. about things turning, you know, pear-shaped in any military sense. But at the same time, of course, any country has to be conscious of building its defence preparedness on the basis of potential adversaries' capability, not their actual or their presumed intent. And that's why there's a willingness to get serious about defence expenditure and a willingness in Australia to embark upon this the submarine enterprise.
In preparation for our conversation today, I was doing some research. I was reading some articles in some of your foreign affairs journals, and they were talking about the primacy of the United States in the Western Pacific and how those days are somewhat numbered. China's a rising power economically, that the days of America's primacy in the Western Pacific is over. That said, I don't think the United States is willing to accept that position as a fait accompli. I think there's a, as the U.S. looks at that map of the Western Pacific, Japan, Korea, down through India, through Vietnam, Australia, there's still a sense that those countries, which traditionally have been U.S. allies, that they'll continue to be so. So it seemed to me that the AUKUS pact was like another piece falling into place in that in America's goal to maintain its position in the Western Pacific.
Yeah, well, let's untangle two separate themes here. One is a continued presence of America in the Western Pacific and indeed the Indian Ocean as a kind of counterweight to excessive Chinese outreach, overreach in all sorts of ways. And I think there's a genuinely great regional willingness to accommodate the U.S. in that role and not to resist it. And in that context, the Quad, for example, the arrangement between the United States, India, Japan, and Australia is seen, I think, right around the region as quite a useful. In that context, the Quad, this relationship between U.S., India, Japan, and Australia is seen right around the region as a pretty useful counterweight to China. Optically, perhaps more significant than militarily, but optically important nonetheless, as showing a willingness of a bunch of highly capable players to not just accept Chinese overreach at face value and to roll over. But the other side of the coin is this is real concern around the region about this U.S. insistence on maintaining not just a presence, a balancing presence in the region, but primacy in the region. Mm-hmm. And this is sort of American exceptionalism at work in a way that does not generate a high degree of comfort or enthusiasm around the region, including in longtime allies and partners like Australia. The reality is that America can't sustain its number one position. It's got to recognize the reality that the way forward is recognizing the reality of China's military and economic power, the reality of China's demand for strategic space of its own, the reality of China's demand to be a global rule maker, not just a rule taker, and its determination to play itself into a role at the very least of equality, not necessarily dominance, but equality. I think the smartest thing I've ever heard said on this, and I've quoted it many times, was actually by your former president, Bill Clinton, 2 years after he left the presidency, 2002, at a meeting I was with him in Los Angeles, private, off the record. But I remember vividly what Clinton said to that crowd. He said, look, America's got two choices about the way in which we use this unrivaled, then unrivaled, economic and military power that we have. Choice number one is to use it to try to stay top dog on the global block in perpetuity. Mm-hmm. Choice number two is to use that power to create a world in which we will be comfortable living when we are no longer top dog on the global block. And I thought that second formulation, which is obviously Clinton's preference, was just pitch perfect. It recognized the reality of the tectonic plate shift and recognized the absolute necessity for a new detente, if you like to put it that way, or a new sort of accommodation of interests that didn't depend on exceptionalism, primacy, preeminence, predominance. So, but it's been very difficult, of course, in the American political context for any of that kind of thinking to gain traction. It's unthinkable still to this day that any American leader would articulate American interests in other than primacy terms. And therein lies a problem for the region, because China is simply not going to accept that, and it does create a source of ongoing tension, which it's very important that we try to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Let's come back to AUKUS and the implementation of AUKUS. I saw that that recently two Virginia-class U.S. submarines had actually docked in and paid visits to Perth. I believe Royal Navy submarines will be stopping by Perth starting in 2026. What are some of the other short-term implementation steps that are underway for this pact?
Well, there's a whole bunch of planning going into effective interoperability, crew training, ship visits, and all the rest of it, because on any view, the nature of the technology involved here is going to involve a huge amount of a further interaction between our two militaries, and that's beginning to happen, and that's expected. But so far, so good. But there's very real questions about deliverability. I do want to come back to the cost-benefit issue for us, back to sovereign agency, but just let's have a look at the moment about the deliverability of this whole enterprise. You'll have been aware of the publicity in the last couple of weeks about the Pentagon budget not making provision for more than one new Virginia-class boat being built next year. And yet, if the US is to meet its own domestic fleet replacements extension targets, it's got to build at least two a year. And if it's going to meet the AUKUS plan of supplying the first of the new Virginias to Australia by the early 2030s, it's got to be building 2.3 ships a year. There's all sorts of excuses being made for this, that this is just part of the gamesmanship always associated with the US budget, and really next year was going to be a low year anyway because we're building the infrastructure for the future rather than building actual boats. But the optics of this are pretty terrible. And in the context of the possibly imminent election of a president who doesn't get it, has never got it, about the nature of alliance relationships, he regards, as we saw last time, them all as encumbrances far more than assets. The notion that there will be any serious willingness to actually deliver on this, if these boats are seen as going to Australia at the expense of building the America's own basic submarine SSN fleet, then I think we've got very real issues about what will happen on the American side. And we've also got very real issues, which I won't burden you with at any length, about the deliverability of the next phase of AUKUS, which is the joint design and build of five wholly new submarines with UK and Australia playing a very prominent role in the building operation. Anyone who has any understanding of the history of complex defence projects in Australia and the UK, for that matter, again, has to be profoundly sceptical. So quite apart from all the other problems, and there are real problems with the AUKUS program, there is every real chance that this thing will fall over. And from an Australian point of view, what worries me and many others at the moment is no obvious plan B to deal with that if it actually happens. That's the practical deliverability. Can we talk a little bit about cost benefits?
Yes, let's...
Sovereign agency, or are we running out of time?
No. Let's wrap up with the cost benefit analysis.
Well, cost-benefit is simply the argument that for an equivalent cost of these eight boats, let's assume they're all delivered and delivered in a reasonably timely way, for the cost of nearly $400 billion over the next 3 decades, we could buy at least 20, 25 and maybe up to 40 conventionally powered boats. And that really, in terms of Australia's actual defence needs, that would be a better deal for us. Given that with eight boats, there's only four of them in the water or on station at any given time.
Right.
You know, we've got 20,000 ship movements coming to Australia a year to protect. We've got a huge coastline to protect. How well can we do that with four boats in the water at any given time? Maybe much better with a whole bunch of conventionally powered boats, much more numerous, less range, sure, but still able to operate very effectively in our own surrounding archipelagic waters. What is the point of having these highly capable, long-distance endurance boats? It's really, I mean, the point of it is really to be a marginal add, from the US point of view, is to be a marginal add-on to US capability.
Right.
In the South China Sea, the surrounds of Taiwan, Northeast Asia generally. From an Australian point of view, the real utility of having a submarine fleet is to protect our own immediate surrounds. I mean, people don't sort of realise the geography of all this. Sydney is much further away from Beijing than Berlin. I mean, it's just people haven't got their heads around the geography. Australia's strategic advantage is our distance.
Yes.
Our distance from, you know, this allegedly or more possible new adversary. Everything, I think, to be said for having a capability which is geared to that reality of taking advantage of our distance and not throwing ourselves into a position where, you know, we're primarily designing this capability to support US in its force projection capability rather than our own defensive capability against such an adversary. So that's that part of the story. The cost-benefit thing is a real, real issue. But to me, if I can just finish on this note, that the real issue for me personally is the issue of sovereign agency. Going back to where I began at the beginning of our talk about, you know, Australia's aspiration to be a genuinely independent player and the aspiration of the Australian public to be that, the notion of being enmeshed to the extent that we will be with this technology and to the extent to which people like Kurt Campbell obviously believe it's highly desirable is not really a thing of beauty. I mean, we do want to retain our own sovereign agency in the way in which these boats are used. And frankly, the nature of this technology and the nature of the program that's being devised at the moment will make us totally dependent into the hereafter on the US for the way in which these boats operate. The notion that America will give us, your country will give us this technology and give us this support without believing that these boats will be available at the flick of a presidential finger should they be called upon to, you know, support the US in some military enterprise in our own region. The notion that we wouldn't be compelled to join in any such enterprise is, I think, just fanciful.
I agree.
I've had some experience with this as foreign minister, and let me just say it for the record. Be careful about how I express it, but it goes back to the first Gulf War, the good Gulf War, 1991 Gulf War, when everybody was united in the belief that there had to be a global pushback against Saddam's invasion, Iraq's invasion of Kuwait. Australia made a couple of ships available to the US for that enterprise, along with some other personnel. Very early on in the enterprise, those ships were ordered basically by the Americans into a particularly vulnerable position, as I remember, in the Strait of Hormuz. Fair enough, but it was a neuralgic issue for us. So I got on the phone to Jim Baker, with whom I had a very good relationship, the then US Secretary of State. And I said, Jim, you know how supportive we are strategically of this whole enterprise and US leadership in it, but this is a neuralgic issue for us, obviously, domestically. We really would have appreciated just a, you know, teensy little bit of consultation before you made this order, basically, to put our ships in potential harm's way. To which the reply, and I don't pretend this is an exact quote, but it gets pretty close, listen, buddy, we're running this effing war, not you.
And sounds like
that,
Baker.
That sort of response in this sort of kinetic war situation does concentrate the mind wonderfully, if you've been there and been in that situation, as I have. So I really fiercely want to retain our capacity for independent decision making before getting caught up in potential military adventures, which may involve a very considerable sacrifice of blood and treasure for us, and maybe, you know, bear no compensating, you know, returns. It's a really serious issue, and I think that's been one that's ticking away in the background to this in the Australian consciousness. And the problem is the present government and the previous government have not really articulated a very credible strategic rationale for this major purchase. And there are real issues about cost benefit, real issues about deliverability, and real issues about just what we're getting into when it comes to maintaining our identity as a fiercely independent country in our own right.
Well, Gareth, on that note, again, I'd like to thank you for joining us today. Are you working on any additional projects that you can share with our listeners?
I'm now moved into my 80th year, Jim, and I'm not working on anything other than staying alive, I think, at the moment.
Well, you do
an occasional small contribution to the public debate on various things about which I feel passionately, like this issue, like nuclear disarmament, like the responsibility to protect against mass atrocity crimes. I'm trying to keep a few of those flames burning. But but basically, it's up to the next generation to solve all these problems. I think I'm pretty much past my use-by date.
I wouldn't go that far. We'll certainly be coming back to you, Gareth, in future as this as the AUKUS pact continues to evolve going forward. And how can our listeners follow you? What is your website?
Oh, my website is www.gevins.org. Very simple. And it's I don't do social media and stuff. I don't actively promote the various bits and pieces that I write, but it is all there in that filing cabinet electronically, and people are welcome to access it, because there's quite a lot of material there addressing all these issues that we've been talking about, and lots of others as well.
Mm-hmm. Gareth Evans, I'd like to thank you very much for joining us, and as I said, I hope you'll accept my invitation to come back and continue to keep us apprised of this AUKUS pact, because we're not getting the full picture here, I think, in the United States. And you've filled in a lot of the blanks for us and for our listeners today. So again, thank you.
My pleasure, Jim. I look forward to further conversation.
And for our listeners, today's episode is number 508. Listen to us on Apple, Spotify, Pandora, 18 platforms, and join our listener base in 60 countries. FeedSpot has recognized us as a top 25 California news podcast, ranking number 12. This has been the San Francisco Experience Podcast with Jim Herlihy, coming to you from San Francisco.